I have rows full of children up here, but nobody wanted to ring the bell, so I rung the bell myself. Good morning, everyone. Most Sundays, we start the service with a simple gathering song, but this month and week, we are celebrating creativity, so we are being creative. And Sam DeLong will share his talent with us by playing Fantasia in D minor to center us all this beautiful morning. Thank you, Sam. So, welcome. You are all welcome here, whether it is your 100th time or your first, whether you are tired or energized, whether you are seeking or settled in your beliefs. The Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan is a place and space for you and for each of us. We do not have a dogma. Our exploration of life is unbounded, drawing from scripture and science, nature and philosophy, personal experience, and ancient tradition. The seven principles we affirm and uphold can be found in your program. And I always think of our vision statement, which is also in your program, as a living thing. Our covenant with each other is to build a strong root system, to allow in light, to stretch with new branches and tender leaves, and to find the strength to weather storms and changing seasons. We tend to each other, and I am grateful for you every day, and grateful you are here today. I don't have any formal announcements today, but announcements, as always, are also listed in your program. And please do watch for some announcements about the Memorial Day picnic that will be coming out. And now also, sorry for those of you that like to be pre-prepared with your hymnals, we are going to do a short call and response, number 665 from the hymnal, number 665, we will do in just a moment. So stay seated, but we'll follow this with a reading and our chalice lighting. Today's service was planned by our 7 and up class, and I'm going to get lots of help, which I'm also grateful for. And so with that, I will pass it to Nick. Nick, please come up.
Joe, you want to come light the chalice? No one ever told us we had to study our lives.
Make of our lives a study, as with learning natural history or music.
That we should begin with the simple exercises first and slowly go on trying the hard ones. And in fact, we can't live like that. We take on everything at once before we've even begun to read or mark time. We're forced to begin in the midst of the hardest movement. So each week in our RE classes, we share the same reading from K. Sri Dhammapada, Echoing the Buddha, when we light our chalice. We have a special way of doing it where the class joins in at certain points, but we don't expect you guys to know how to do that. But me and the class will do it today like we normally do. Joey's already lit the chalice, and the chalice represents the sparks within all of us combining to create a flame. The thought manifests as the word manifests as the deed develops into habit, and habit hardens into character. So watch the thought and its ways with care, and let them spring forth from love, born out of compassion for all beings, as the shadow follows the body, as we think, so we become. And now please stand as you're able for hymn 296, Wake Now My Senses.
Thank you.
And now, I'm just full of being pleased today. It is my pleasure to introduce our special music. Sonata for Tuba and Piano was composed by our very own Christopher Banner. For those of you that don't know Christopher, can you give us a wave? Thank you. So, and it will be performed by Stephen Maxwell and Renee Reisner. But before, I know you've just grabbed your tuba. I'm so sorry, Stephen. But before we begin the performance, so we're celebrating creativity this month, and I asked if there was anything special I needed to say. And so the special thing is that in addition to composing this piece, Christopher handcrafted the mute for the tuba, the copper mute for the tuba. And he believes that there are about two like that in the whole world. So we're very pleased. And when we talk about creativity, let's just say this is the real thing. So thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was a treat. John Lou asked me to say one thing with the announcements, and I, of course, promptly forgot it. If anyone has joys or concerns, they can write them on the cards that were on the seats when we came in, and they will be collected at the same time as the offering. So please be aware that that's how we can all share with each other. And now I would ask all the children to come up for the story for all ages. Ethan Martinson and Noah Meyer are going to be our readers, so go ahead and take your seats. And they are going to share with us The Ant and the Elephant. And kids, could you sit down? Kids, please sit down in front of them so you can actually see the book as they read it. All right. Are you ready?
So today we are going to be reading The Ant and the Elephant by Bill Peet. And so, ta-da, here we go. So it starts out, and there is an ant, you can see, and he's climbing. Yeah, I could. Okay, fine, I'll read the beginning. One morning, a tiny ant curled up a tall blade of jungle grass for, I can't, my glasses read. For a view of the river. All at once, he was caught by a breeze that sent the... What? That sent him sailing off into the swirling water. Just when it seemed he would be swept downstream and gone forever, the ant grabbed onto a snag of... Oh, and scrambled to safety.
There. The ant remained stranded, wondering what he would do, when he spied a mud turtle creeping along the riverbank. "Oh, Mr. Hardshell," called the ant in his wee, small voice, "would you be so kind as to give me a lift back to dry land? It's a nice day for a swim."
The old turtle turned his head slowly. After a long look at the ant, he said, "I've had my swim for today, and besides, if I went racing about helping everyone who was in trouble, I'd have no time left to relax." Then the turtle tottered on his way to find a place where he could sun himself.
When the turtle came to the flat, warm rock, he crept slowly up the edge. Suddenly, he went toppling backward and landed upside down. "Blast it all," he muttered. Dad blame it, and he began thrashing out with his legs, desperately trying to right himself. But all the kicking could do was send him rocking about on his shell. That was all.
As he stretched his stringy neck, looking about for help, the turtle spied a hornbill roosting on her high nest on a tree limb. "Oh, Mrs. Big Bill," he called, "would you mind helping me back on my feet? With one flip of your beak, I'm sure you could do it." "I could," snapped the bird, "but I won't. This will teach you to be less clumsy."
As she leaned down to say more, the hornbill tipped the nest, and her one big egg rolled out to go tumbling all the way to the ground. Luckily, it landed in a clump of fluff-tough weeds without so much as a crack.
"Thank goodness," she cried when she found her egg in one piece. Then, seizing it in her beak, she fluttered her wings as she tried to take off. But her oversized beak, plus the cumbersome egg, were too much of a load. Still, she kept on furiously thrashing the air until her wings were torn to a frazzle.
As the miserable bird sat staring helplessly at the egg, a giraffe came striding along. "Oh, Mr. Great Neck," she called, "you've come just at the right time. If I perched on your head with the egg in my beak, you could carry us back up to my nest." "Indeed, no," scoffed the proud giraffe. "If I did such a thing, how silly I would look. I'll have no one laughing at me, no indeed." And Mr. Great Neck went on his way with his head held high, nibbling at the treetops.
He was so intent upon the tasty leaves, he didn't notice the tangle-dangle vine until it was twisted around one leg. "Here now," snorted the giraffe with an angry kick. "How dare you?" The kick nearly gave the vine an extra twist, which tightened its grip.
Then, in a fury, the giraffe began kicking wildly about. The more he kicked, the more entangled he became. Finally, his legs were so tightly tied up in the vine, he couldn't budge.
As he stood there in the tangle, he spied a lion heading his way. "What good luck," thought the giraffe. "With those great claws of his, he could rip this vine to shreds in one swipe." "Oh, Mr. Big Paw," he called to the lion, "just look at me." The lion took one lift and then burst into great roaring laughter. "That is funny. Ho, ho, I see what you mean. Ho, 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 ho." And laughing merrily, he went on his way through the jungle.
The lion was still laughing to himself as he flopped down in a patch of shade for a bit of a catnap. He flopped down with such a whump it upset a huge boulder, which was all set to topple. To the lion's surprise, it rolled over and came down right upon his tail.
With a furious roar, he leaped to his feet, tugging frantically to free himself. But soon he found it was useless to struggle. He could never set loose unless he was willing to part with his tail.
As he sat there growling over his bad luck, a rhino came along. "Oh, Mr. Hornyhead," he called, "would you mind bumping the stupid boulder off my tail? One nudge of your great snout would do it."
"I would," said the rhino, "if you could think of some way to repay the favor." "Right now," sighed the lion, "all I can think of is my poor tail." "Too bad," said the rhino, and he went on lumbering through the jungle.
The rhino never bothered to watch where he was going. With a great horn out in front, he went plowing straight ahead through the brambles and brush. With all of a sudden, whomp, he blundered head onto a stump with his great horn stuck deep into it.
"Out of my way, you stupid stump," he snorted, and with a furious lunge, he tried to knock over the stump. This drove the horn still deeper. Then, with a mighty tug, he tried pulling himself free, but the stump refused to let go. At last, the rhino realized he was hopelessly stuck.
So the rhino, the lion, the giraffe, the hornbill, the turtle, and the ant were all left in deep trouble. That would have been if a jolly big somebody hadn't decided to take a stroll through the jungle that day.
Okay. It was a huge elephant with such great spreading ears he could hear even the slightest sound. The faint rustle of a leaf, the least snap of a twig, or even the tiny voice of an ant calling.
He reached his long trunk out over the river, inviting the ant to climb aboard, then carried him safely back to dry land. "How can I ever thank you enough?" said the grateful ant. "It was no big thing," said the elephant. "But it was a big thing for me," said the ant. "It was everything," and he scurried away through the grass.
"If you've got time to bother with the nothing of an ant," grumbled this old turtle, "how about me?" "You are in a pickle," said the elephant, and with the tip of his trunk, he flipped the turtle back onto his feet.
And without a word of thanks, the old codger went tottering away down the bank to disappear in the river.
"If you can help an ugly old turtle," squawked the hornbill, "the least you can do is put my lovely egg back in the nest." "The very least I can do," agreed the elephant. Holding the egg gently in his trunk, he carried it up to the nest.
"It was a wonder you didn't crack it," snapped the bird as she settled down onto the egg. "Say now," chuckled the elephant when he came upon the giraffe, "that's what I call a funny fix." "Not funny to me," snorted the giraffe. "Not one bit funny." "Then I'll try not to laugh," said the big fellow, searching through the vine with his trunk to get the worst of the tangle.
It took a few minutes to undo the dozens of knots that gripped the long legs. Once they were loose, the vine fell limply to the ground. "Well, I must say it's about time," snorted the giraffe as he went gullipity-clopping away.
"What have we here?" asked the elephant when he came upon the lion. "We have a big, stupid, bumbling boulder," growled the lion. "That's what." "Then be off, stupid boulder," and the huge tusker heaved the boulder into the air with his trunk and sent it tumbling.
Once he was free, the lion gave his tail a few switches to make sure it was working. "What a relief," sighed the lion. "Someday, when I'm in a better mood, I must remember to thank you." "No hurry," said the elephant. He continued on his way through the jungle, where he soon found a helplessly stuck rhino.
"I can pull you free," said the elephant, if your tail can stand one mighty tug. "Right now it's my snout I'm worried about," groaned the rhino, so jerk away. Gripping the rhino's tail tightly in his trunk, the elephant reared back, and with one almighty jerk, the rhino went sailing free of the stump to land with one big bump. "That was one whale of a jerk," muttered the rhino. "I hope you get some fun out of it." "It was a pleasure," smiled the elephant, and he went merrily on his way.
He was enormously pleased with himself after all the good deeds he had done that day. "Everyone has his troubles," he chuckled. "Everyone but big me. I'll never get into a fix where I need help. That's one thing for sure." The elephant didn't suspect there was a deep ravine just ahead. It was too well hidden by scatterflat ferns.
Before he knew it, he had tumbled straight into it, landing with a 7-ton thud that shook the whole jungle. He was wedged so deep in such a position that his trunk and his legs were useless. "Serves me right," he muttered, "for feeling so almighty, big, and all-powerful. Now I'm the one who needs help." "Help," he bellowed. "Help, help, help." Then he waited anxiously for a reply. He waited for hours, staring up at the sky until it faded into evening and a deep stillness settled over the jungle.
It was so quiet, his great spreading ears caught the last sound of footsteps, tiny, tiny footsteps from somewhere above. "Who's there?" asked the elephant. "It's me," said a wee small voice. "The ant you rescued this morning and all my ant friends, 95,000 of them." I know ants are amazingly strong," said the elephant, "but surely you don't expect to lift me out of here." "We can try," said the ant. "Come on, my friends, let's get to work."
Suddenly, down the steep wall of the ravine came a teeming horde of ants swarming under the elephant. Then all together they began chanting, "Heave, ho, heave, ho, up you go," and to the elephant's amazement, he felt himself moving upward. Slowly but surely, just an inch at a time, the tireless ants hoisted their huge burden up the wall.
"Heave ho, up you go, don't lose your grip, don't anyone trip," and at last, under a bright full moon, they set the elephant down in the scatterflat ferns. "That was tremendous," cried the elephant. "I can't believe it." "It was nothing," replied the 95,000 ants. "Nothing for you," said the elephant, "but a mighty big thing for me. Now, if you'll climb aboard, I'll give you a ride back to your anthill."
"I'm not one bit tired," said one ant, "but I would like a ride. I've never ridden on an elephant." "Neither have I," cried all the others, and they swarmed up the elephant's legs onto his back. Then away they went, rumpity bumpity, clumpity hump, the mighty big and the mighty small, off through the jungle together.
Oh, wait, we're not singing you out just yet. Okay, so that was a story about compassion. Do you guys know the word compassion? Somebody want to try to guess what compassion means? Do you know, Sean? You do? If you had to guess, what was that story about? It's about elephants. Elephants are evidently very compassionate. Okay, so some of the animals didn't want to help each other, right? And some of the animals weren't very nice when they did get help, right? So I'm going to throw one of my family members under the bus. My niece Willow, she does not like to be helped. And in fact, when you help her, sometimes she gets really angry. Do you guys know anybody like that? Somebody wants to do everything for themselves and they get a little bit angry when people try to help them? Well, that is wonderful. Yeah. So what do you think? Do you think we should always wait until someone asks for help before we help them?
I do help.
You do help? That's good. Okay, so Rose is saying...
It depends if they really need it or if it's just a little problem and they could probably do it.
Okay, so wait and see if it's a big problem or a small problem. That's good advice. Do you think you should always be on the lookout to see if anybody needs help?
Yeah.
Do you ever notice anybody who needs help and you don't do anything about it? Like the turtle and the... Sometimes. Okay. Well, I would encourage you to look out for others who need help and maybe ask if they want it. That's always a good thing. But I appreciate our young men reading the story here today. And I appreciate all of you. So we'll sing you back to your class now. Thank you.
So I believe, my name is Kathy Hedge, and I believe I'm speaking to a very engaged crowd. So I hope to give you information that you may be able to use with friends and neighbors that might not be quite so engaged. And that is that you have the right to vote, so use it. And marching is not enough, so vote. And I would like to thank our presenters up here. Yes. Yay. Beautiful, beautiful. And if you'd like to put those away, you can. You don't have to stand up there. But you're a lovely backdrop. Thank you. So we're in for the next 40 days, we are responding to the national call of the Poor People's Campaign, the Poor People's Campaign. And there are so many things that we need to deal with. But there is one thing that all citizens can do, and that, of course, is to vote. So I want to share with you just some information, some recent information. I'm going to open with pieces from an article from the New York Times, and this was back in March, March 10th. Vote, that's just what they don't want you to do. This is a fragile moment for the nation. Oh, this is by the editorial board. This is a fragile moment for the nation. The integrity of democratic institutions is under assault from without and within, and basic standards of honesty and decency in public life are corroding. If you are horrified at what is happening in Washington and in many states, you can march in the streets. You can go to town halls and demand more from your representatives. You can share the latest outrageous news on your social media feed, all worthwhile activities. But none of that matters if you don't go out and vote. It's a perennial conundrum for the world's oldest democracy. Why do so many Americans fail to go to the polls? Some abstainers think they are registering a protest against the awful choices. They're fooling themselves. Non-voters aren't protesting anything. They're just putting their lives and futures in the hands of the people who probably don't want them to vote. We've seen recently what can happen when people choose instead to take their protest to the ballot box. We saw it in Virginia in November. We saw it, to our astonishment, in Alabama. We may see it in western Pennsylvania, which we did. Voting matters. So the first time I voted was in 1972. The Vietnam War was raging. Nixon was up to dirty tricks, and I was sure the youth were going to change everything. It was the very first time the 18, 19, and 20-year-olds were allowed to vote or could vote, and I was sure that those who were being drafted would vote besides just chanting, "Hell no, we won't go," which was the chant they used at the time because there was the draft. Many did vote. 52% of the 18 to 24-year-olds, the highest ever on record. But that also means nearly half didn't vote. Now the prediction for the upcoming midterms is the millennials may cast less than 10% of the total ballots. The voting for the 18 to 29-year-olds was only 43% in the 2016 election, and it was lower in Kansas by 6 percentage vote than the national average. The last midterm where we elected our past governor was the lowest voter turnout since World War II. So that's pretty severe. So another striking characteristic, though, is those who miss that first opportunity to vote never vote for the rest of their lives. So that first vote really is the most important. So what's happening? Well, there's lots of different theories, but one very interesting one I came across that I had not heard before is that the transiency of our young people is having a huge impact, because you're more invested in your community if you own a home or if your payroll taxes are going to support the schools, if you have little ones. All of those things are very important to you. But our young people are settling down much later, and the economy, of course, has a lot to do with that. So in the 1970s, the average American woman was under 21 when she married and started the children, and home ownership came soon after. But today, women marry at 26, if they marry at all. So they don't settle down as much, so they're not as attached to the political system, which I thought I had not heard that before, which I think was great. I mean, great information. But there are also many intentional things that are happening to prevent people from voting, and that was the gist of the New York Times article. So many states have passed laws that suppress the vote, and we've been fighting against those laws, especially in Kansas, since a section of the National Voter Rights Act was nullified by the Supreme Court in 2013. States that that previously could not pass any voting laws until it was approved by the panel, now they're free to do what they want until it goes through the process of lawsuits before something changed. So half of the voter restriction laws that have been put in place are in states that were that were prevented from doing so before by the Voting Rights Act. So we need to renew that Voting Rights Act desperately. Our voting machines are aging, many lacking a paper trail, and software from the 90s. I don't have any piece of equipment in my house that has software from the 90s, unless I get my old Macintosh out just for fun. So, and the current administration has not spent any of the over $100 million that they were given to prevent the hacking, none of by which we experienced by the Russians. None of that has been spent. So, and so it's very, very serious. And but the biggest problem that we have is that low participation of the voters. In the last election, 102 million eligible voters didn't vote, not even registered to vote. That's more than any votes that were cast for a single candidate. So what can we do? One, as I mentioned earlier, is we need to renew that Voting Rights Act and pass automatic voter registration. It's exciting that already 12 states have that. If you interact at all with a federal institution, your driver's license, getting your taxes paid, any kind of interaction, then you are automatically registered unless you opt out. That's already happening in that's already happening in 12 states and Washington, D.C., and another 20 states have introduced legislation. It's not through yet, but they've introduced it. Automatic mail-in ballots have been incredibly successful. Oregon was the first to do that, and it's really changing things. The Brennan Center estimates that if we had automatic voter registration, we'd save money, increase accuracy, and add 50 million voters to our rolls. We are fighting cases about gerrymandering against the voter ID laws. People are telling their stories. Youth voter registration is up really high, but we still need to get out there and vote. So when I'm talking to to people who tell me all the reasons why they don't vote, one thing that is really helpful to do them is to tell them to close your eyes. Now, in the back of your eyelids, imagine that person who is the exact opposite of you. When you stand up, they sit down. You say yes, they say no. Everything you stand for, everything that you believe, all your values, that individual is the exact opposite. If they vote and you don't, you have just given them your voice, and we can't do that. So, and also encourage people to vote with a federal form, because then they don't have to turn in their ID, their proof of citizenship in Kansas. And there's a website called ksvotes.org. You can register to vote using the federal form. That's ksvotes.org. And that's really pretty exciting. So, again, it's your voice. Let's use it. Let's get all of those we know out there to find out what's happening and make that real change in all of those things that the Poor People's Campaign is standing for. Thank you very much.
The time of offering represents voluntary generosity to sustain and strengthen this place. All offerings are received in grateful appreciation of our shared hopes and values. Please enjoy the talents of Renee Reisner while we pass the baskets creatively made by member Edith Heindrichs many years ago.
Thank you. Community grows in many ways, from listening and learning together, from sitting and singing together. One of the ways community grows is through sharing our hearts with one another. Each week, when we listen to joys and concerns, we hear a sampling of what has touched the people in our congregation over recent days. This allows us to better hold one another in our hearts and minds, and that builds community.
Josiah David Lott is joyful this morning because he says, "I'm glad we're going to church." And similarly, Hayden says, "We're here at church." Sylvia wants to thank all the people who came for work day. Were some of you here? You can raise your hands higher. Thank you. Sybil is grateful for her garden and brought organically grown goodies to share this morning, so please help yourself. And we end on a note of sadness. Katie Kingery Page says that a family we love very much is going through very hard times. Please keep this family in your thoughts.
And now the words of Frederick E. Gillis. We are part of a web of life that makes us one with all humanity, one with all the universe. We are grateful for the miracle of consciousness that we share, the consciousness that gives us the power to remember, to love, to care.
Okay, so we are running long, folks, so I'm cutting out paragraphs as we talk. I got to give time for the kids to speak and for you all to participate in an exercise. This spring semester, I had the joy of leading the 7 and Up class through the Virtue Ethics curriculum from the National Unitarian Universalist Association. This is my favorite curriculum that I've come across in volunteering for RE for many years. The curriculum is comprised of 12 workshops on the following topics: decision-making, moderation, integrity, respect, fairness, responsibility, compassion, humility, generosity, courage, forgiveness, and loyalty. Adolescence is a time of great growth, and not just physically. This program, Virtue Ethics, offers an opportunity to try to address 4 of the 10 tasks of adolescence. Participants in this discussion-heavy program should develop and apply a more complex level of perspective taking. They should develop and apply coping skills such as decision making, problem solving, and conflict resolution. They should understand and express more complex emotional experiences, and, very importantly, start to identify their own personal and meaningful moral standards, values, and belief systems. The general flow of these workshops is to introduce the virtue of the week, define it, discuss it, maybe read a story or do an activity, and then apply some of the provided dilemmas. In a few minutes, Ronan, Carrie, and Sam will share some details about 3 of these workshops with you, and then we'll all do a discussion exercise as we did in class together. One particularly memorable week for me was when John Alou visited our class. It was the week we discussed responsibility. John Alou knew, we did an exercise where we read a number of quotes about interconnectedness, and John Alou knew basically every single author as the kids were reading the quotes aloud. So I was very impressed and decided at that moment I would never play her in any trivia game. So I learn by teaching. So that's what I learned that week. But also that week, I'm going to pick on Ronan. Also that week, we're discussing responsibility, and Ronan basically said that because he was raised in this fellowship, of course he felt responsible to others, like he didn't have a choice. You know, the brainwashing is working. The brainwashing is working. And then I am going to go ahead and read a short story about from the week we covered generosity. So it's a wisdom tale from many cultures, including Buddhist tradition. So a woman was passing through a forest. There among the leaves was something shiny. She wiped away the leaves and dirt and beheld a beautiful large gem. "My, this is pretty," she said. She put the jewel in her pouch and continued on her way. When the sun was high, she sat under a tree to eat her simple lunch. She was barely settled when she saw a figure approaching. It was a man, and to judge from his dress, a poor man. "Kind and gentle lady, do you have any food to share with a poor beggar?" I have plenty, she smiled. Digging into her small sack, she pulled out the gem that was on top and the loaf of bread and a piece of cheese. She offered the bread and cheese to the beggar, but the beggar's eyes had grown big at the sight of the lovely gem. Sweet lady, that is a magnificent jewel, he exclaimed. Yes, do you like it? Here, take it too. And she gave him the gem, the bread, and the cheese. The beggar could not believe his luck. He wrapped the gem in his cloak and quickly scampered off. The woman rose and started on her way again. She was surprised a few minutes later to hear footsteps behind her. She turned and saw the beggar before her again. The beggar held out the jewel. Wise woman, may I give this back to you? I don't want it. What do you want? She asked. I want whatever it is you have that allowed you to give it away. So that's the type of stories we would sometimes read in class, and I like that one. And that helped us discover as a group whether or not we individually, the kids do have a voice and are not brainwashed in this process, whether or not we believe there is value in a virtue that can be unmeasured but profound. And I will now pass it to Ronan, who will do courage, who will immediately be followed by Carrie for compassion, and Sam for forgiveness. So, Ronan, please.
In our lesson about courage, we started the lesson by discussing the difference between bravery and courage. Bravery is the ability to confront pain, danger, or attempts of intimidation without any feeling of fear. Courage, on the other hand, is the ability to undertake an overwhelming difficulty or pain despite the imminent and unavoidable presence of fear. Sometimes people say, be brave, as though a person can simply ignore their fear, when really we should say, have courage. Courage means there is effort and maybe even struggle involved. Our lesson encouraged thinking about fictional characters, and we read this quote from Atticus Finch in Harper Lee's novel, To Kill a Mockingbird. I wanted you to see what real courage is, instead of getting the idea that courage is a man with a gun in his hand. It's when you know you're licked before you begin, but you begin anyways, and you see it through no matter what. We are also reminded about this bumper sticker. Lord, help me be the person my dog thinks I am. Sometimes we act courageously because we do not want to disappoint those we love, including our dogs. Sometimes we care especially about emulating the good qualities of people we admire and respect. When we try to apply these concepts to our own lives, learning to swim offered a lot of examples for us to discuss, and quite frankly, some big parenting fails. But one of the important things we explored while discussing courage is the moments when we don't show, courage. When reflecting back on missed opportunities slash lack or lack of courage, we can feel guilt or regret. We were reminded that the virtues we were learning about overlap and that compassion directed to oneself is humility. I want to ask you all to take a moment of quiet self-reflection now. Close your eyes and think of something you really want to do, but you are not sure you have the courage to do it. I'm not necessarily looking for a physically risky activity, such as skydiving or snowboarding. Try to think of something at which failure could mean hurt feelings or a loss of esteem. For example, speaking up when someone's behavior bothers you could lead to a better relationship with that person, but it is risky and could call for courage. Try to challenge yourself, and I'll give you a minute. Thank you. I hope you will consider carrying out your act of courage. Our lesson ended with this quote from Mary Ann Rademacher. Courage doesn't always roar. Sometimes courage is the little voice at the end of the day that says, I'll try again tomorrow.
Hi, good morning. Our lesson on compassion started with this quote from Simone de Beauvoir. One life has value so long as one attributes value to the life of others by means of love, friendship, indignation, and compassion. Have you ever seen a competitive ice skater miss a move and fall on the ice? Did you say, ouch? If so, your brain was probably using minor neurons. Minor neurons are brain cells that specialize in carrying out and understanding not just the actions of others, but also their intentions, the social meaning of their behavior, and their emotions. Scientists first discovered the work of minor neurons almost 20 years ago while monitoring the brain functions of monkeys. They discovered that certain regions of the brain were active when monkeys ate peanuts. Then, much to their surprise, they discovered that the same regions of the brain were active when the monkeys watched a lab assistant eat a peanut. The regions were also active when the monkeys simply heard someone open a peanut. We now know that minor neurons in humans are even more developed and flexible than in monkeys. This makes sense because human society is extremely dependent on each of us understanding and engaging with not only the actions of other members of society, but also the reasons and emotions behind these actions. Sometimes people distinguish sympathy from compassion by saying sympathy is feeling sorry for someone, but compassion means you feel their pain and want to alleviate it. The difference was important to our understanding of virtues and compassion in action. Greek philosophers believed true happiness resulted when something fulfills its true purpose. They believed the true purpose of a human being is to survive, thrive, and form meaningful relationships. Compassion is central to many religions, including Buddhism, Confucianism, and Christianity. Acts of loving kindness are commanded in Judaism. And from the 2009 Charter for Compassion, it says, "Compassion impels us to work tirelessly to alleviate the suffering of our fellow creatures, to dethrone ourselves from the center of our world and to put another there, and to honor the sanctity of every single human being, treating everybody without exception with absolute justice, equity, and respect. It is also necessary to both public and private life to refrain consistently from empathetically from inflicting pain, to act or speak violently out of spite, chauvinism, or self-interest, to impoverish, exploit, or deny basic rights to anybody, and to incite hatred by denigrating others, even our enemies, is a denial of our common humanity. We urgently need to make compassion a clear, luminous, and dynamic force in our polarized world. Rooted in a principled determination to transcend selfishness, compassion can break down political, dogmatic, ideological, and religious boundaries." We closed our lesson with this prayer from Elizabeth Tarbo. "Life, I give thanks. When the light catches the tears in others' eyes, let us be present. Let us seek to be present to another's pain, to bathe another's wounds, to hear another's sadness, celebrate another's success, and allow the other's story to change our own. Let us not defend ourselves against the discomfort of unruly emotion, nor seek to close down our hearts for fear of a new love will come to shake our foundations. Let us instead be open, for in giving ourselves to what we do not understand, we receive life's blessings, and in taking care of another, we are cared for." Thank you.
Okay. So our lesson on forgiveness also included a lot of quotes. One from Gandhi: "The weak can never forgive. Forgiveness is the attribute of the strong." And then one from novelist Faith Baldwin: "I think one should forgive and remember. To look even regularly upon what you remember and know you've forgiven is achievement." And then the third one, ethicist Lewis B. Smeads said, "You will know that forgiveness has begun when you recall those who hurt you and feel the power to wish them well." We can make clear what forgiveness is by being clear what it isn't. Forgiving another person does not necessarily mean you will reconcile a relationship, nor that a person has apologized or even asked to be forgiven. Forgiving another certainly does not mean that what that person did was okay, or that they are getting away with it, whatever it may be. For most of us, the advice to forgive and forget is often unrealistic. So how do we choose to embrace forgiveness as part of our personal development and improvement? It is helpful to think about forgiveness as a path or a journey instead of a finite act. Each week, we often went through an exercise brainstorming the upside and downside of each virtue, but for forgiveness, we instead brainstormed what it felt like to be unforgiving or unforgiven.
To be unforgiven is like feeling guilty, sad, angry, helpless, accountable, confused, and frustrated. And to be unforgiving is like feeling angry, spiteful, disappointed, cold, hurt, vengeful, bitter, resentful, and sad. No one in our group wanted to feel this way. No one wanted to feel helpless. No one wanted to feel resentful. So we tried to process that forgiveness. So we tried to process that forgiveness can be a release of these negative feelings. We were asked to think of roadblocks and doorways to forgiveness, and to consider what we could or should focus on to steer our minds towards forgiveness. An example from Judaism was given. The Jewish holy day of Yom Kippur is also known as the Day of Atonement. It is a day set aside to atone for the sins of the past year. On Yom Kippur, God's judgment is entered into a book and sealed. This day is essentially your last appeal, your last chance to change the judgment, to demonstrate your repentance and make amends. But Yom Kippur atones only for sins between man and God, not for sins against another person. To atone for sins against another person, you must first seek reconciliation with that person, righting the wrongs you committed against them if possible. That must be done before Yom Kippur. As Unitarian Universalists, we don't have to prepare for Yom Kippur. However, that doesn't bind us against forgiveness. What if you delivered an apology that was long overdue? What if you let go of a disappointment that makes you sad? Would your life be better? I'll repeat Gandhi's quote here. The weak can never forgive. Forgiveness is the attribute of the strong.
Thank you very much. Okay, so we have a number of dilemmas that I'm going to hand out to the kids, and they're each going to take one or two, and they're each going to start mingling with the congregation to get people in small discussion groups. So these are the actual dilemmas that were provided for us each week with the virtues, and they are team-based. They're framed for young people. Some of you adults might find that there's a simple answer to the dilemma that is posed to you. Please take a moment and consider why it might have been challenging for you if you were still a teenager. And so I want to give you a few minutes to discuss these dilemmas amongst yourselves, and it will be just a very few short minutes. And then we'll ask for some feedback maybe from a couple groups. And I'm putting Jonalu on the spot to moderate that discussion in case she can add any wisdom that doesn't reside with me this morning. So kids, go out there and distribute your dilemmas and actually talk to people and one another and all that sort of stuff. Okay. I think some of you thought the dilemmas were easy. I heard that. You wouldn't be good class participants, probably. Okay, thank you, everyone. It did sound like there was lively discussion, and I would strongly encourage you to continue to discuss these dilemmas at coffee hour, which should be in 3 minutes, but is probably going to be in more like 5 or 6. So just note that. And Jonalu, again, will come up and share any wisdom. Did anybody have a dilemma that they actually thought was hard and they had good discussion and they'd be willing to share something with the rest of the group?
I thought it was hard and we didn't solve it.
Okay, what was your dilemma about?
Responsibility.
Okay. Anybody else have a good dilemma that caused good discussion to have? Okay.
You guys want to both talk about it? There you go. Okay, so
fairness.
Yeah, we did fairness.
We did fairness.
Yeah, and it was a person who got a role in a musical because they did good last year, and the person's two friends had been hoping to try out for the role, and so it was tricky.
But one of the friends got the role in the musical last time they did it, so we decided that the person who got it last time wouldn't get it this time because they got it last time and they already got it.
And I think
I was thinking that he should talk to the director and have the director actually do fair auditions to let other people have the chance to prove that they could actually be better at the role.
And we talked about how even as grown-ups, it's really hard to say no to something that you're getting because of a privilege that other people don't have.
Yeah, I'm struck that these dilemmas are, I mean, they're not just teenage dilemmas. They're really, I mean, it may not be the exact terms that translate into what we deal with, but there are dilemmas, too, as adults.
Did anybody get the one about texting, moderation? There was a lot of texting going on. You know, maybe that's not a relevant exact dilemma to adults, but I think in adult friendships, regardless of your age, some people can want a lot more contact than you do, and it's hard to moderate. Okay, anybody else have a particularly good one they'd like to share with us? Good conversation? Okay. Karen, you don't want to? You or Harriet? Okay. We have to have two examples.
Well, ours was on if a relative makes a homophobic joke or a racial joke, yeah. What do you do? And her response was to ask them why they feel that way, and I think that's a good start.
Another great example of how these are adult dilemmas as well.
And the reason that that one was framed as respect was, who do you show respect to? The person that was just denigrated, or perhaps your elder, if it's a grandparent or something like that. So, yeah, these are virtues we have to balance. Any closing thoughts? You're good.
I just want to thank Molly and our youth, our 7 and up class, for putting together this service and sharing with us what they're learning, and to really deeply appreciate how well-informed and articulate and just inspiring our young people are. So thank you very much.
Please open your hymnals to number 346. Stand as you're able for Come Sing a Song with Me. I'm going to now read number 686. Go in peace. Live simply, gently, at home in yourselves. Act justly. Speak justly. Remember the depth of your own compassion. Forget not your power in the days of your powerlessness. Do not desire to be wealthier than your peers, and stint not your hand of charity. Practice forbearance. Speak the truth, or speak not. Take care of yourselves as bodies, for you are a good gift. Crave peace for all people in the world, beginning with yourselves, and go as you go with the dream of that peace alive in your heart.
Thank you, everyone. That closes our service.